Welcome back, all UX researchers and UX research hopefuls. This is Emily Hutnick, your host for All Things Insightful on the UXRTO podcast. This month's August 2018 episode of Insights starts right now. Our first story comes from Fast Company, and they're talking a little bit about how AI is being used in ways that we probably haven't anticipated yet, and how these ways that are customer and public facing can really shape the experience that someone has with the company. This article is titled How to Nail an Interview with a Chatbot, and it's written by Gwen Morin. She says, the chatbots are coming, and you may need to impress them to have a shot at your next job. This might not be all that surprising, though, because as key functions of human resources are already being automated, it's only natural that bots and other AI systems are slowly starting to creep in on things like recruitment. This is because recruitment is a lot of time and effort and investment for relatively little reward when you think about how many resumes and cover letters people need to go through before they get to the hiring process and then complete it. So 15% of HR leaders in the last Harvey Nash 2017 HR survey say that artificial intelligence and automation are currently affecting their workforce plans, while 40% expect such innovation to have an impact within 5 years. But that's happening right now. Brian Westfall, senior content analyst with Capterra, a software information and review service, said that chatbots are definitely a big deal right now in the recruiting space. As we said before, recruiters have to sort through so many different resumes and cover letters, and that takes so much time and so much of an investment to find someone who will perfectly fit your organization. With chatbots, it might be easier for people to apply and make their way through that first stage of recruitment without human involvement at all. Proponents say that chatbots allow companies to better manage this onslaught and immediately eliminate obviously unqualified candidates. And then doing so allows recruiters to focus on candidates that are more likely to be a good fit, writes Gwen. So this is pretty interesting, and I'm super curious at this point how this is going to affect the user experience. So at Irvine, a California-based customer interaction platform, Alcorica, chatbots have been used in their Philippines operations for nearly 2 years and are embedded in job ads placed on US platforms like CareerBuilder and Facebook and everything like that. So they typically interact well answering basic chatbot questions for initial screenings. That's the people who are applying, that is. These people have the option of applying to these jobs by either typing responses and filling in kind of form-like answers but in a chatbot way, or they can upload voice or video responses if they wish, which would be a really interesting personal touch to a standard job application. Although there's no explicit statement that screening is done via chatbot, which is kind of concerning, but I won't go there, he says that candidates can usually figure out that they're not interacting with a human because of the straightforward and uniform way the questions are asked. Alorica's bots screen roughly 100,000 candidates in Asia operations, and that's pretty significant. It means that people can also ask the chatbot about things about the business and about the company and the position. It also asks them about basic skills and experience necessary for the job. Some of the questions that the chatbot can answer are basic things about the job, salary, and other aspects of a typical job description. About 35% of Alcor's interactions with prospective candidates are coming through chatbots now. So this eliminates people who are clearly unqualified or, you know, aren't very professional, and easily weeds these people out, and the ones that are really great get get fast-tracked onto the recruiter's desk, essentially. This article goes on to talk about what the best conduct is for understanding how to be interviewed by a chatbot and how to get your way to the next steps, but they're pretty straightforward, and I will let you finish that article yourself. Just for a tidbit of what you can expect, it says, stay professional, think friend, not foe, keep it simple and to the point, proofread your responses, and also follow up. But I will let you follow up with this article. What I'm really interested about these chatbots is not only what the user experience is like to be essentially interviewed by a chatbot, but can these resources, this information, these responses from potential and new hires, assuming people do get hired, can these be used for research? And not just market research or business research, but user experience research. Are there ways that you can use this to better understand how people are applying to jobs? The best way to reach them based on what times of day that they're filling them out. For example, in the article, it stated that chatbots are a great way for people to apply to jobs because they're usually on their cell phones, and this is very easily accessible on your cell phone. And the way that the easy text interaction goes, you can basically fill it out at any point. So this could mean that instead of sending in a resume and a cover letter, you just do the application in the chat. Usually you'd have to upload your resume and your cover letter from your desktop, let's say, but this alleviates the need to do that. So people can do it literally wherever they have a cell phone connection and a phone in their hand. This could open up some really interesting insights for people on research teams, especially if you're trying to improve the process of hiring and HR in general in your company. Sometimes research, in case you're not aware, isn't always customer facing. Sometimes the research can be internally facing. It can be about the processes and the ways that your company goes about doing things and how to better move them around and interpret them so that they will in fact be better for the customer. This is a great example of how you can scrape all kinds of data and potentially amalgamate it and study it so your company can better understand who they're actually trying to hire and why. And not only that, but who is applying and why. Do you find that having a chatbot would give you access to people who might not have the time of day to sit down at a desk and apply to jobs? Maybe, for example, you're getting more applications from mothers who are on mat leave because they have a phone in one hand and their kid in the other as they're applying to the job. Or maybe it's for people who work strange hours and aren't able to sit down at their desk when they get home, so they're doing it on their way home while they're commuting. There's really interesting implications that could come out of this, and I guess the larger insight from this for me, and hopefully for you, would be to try to see where you can grasp any kind of research data that your company has. You might not think that a chatbot or something else that your company has that's gathering data would be very useful to research, but you never know what you could find. This next topic might be a little bit uncomfortable for some people, but it is necessary that we talk about it, especially in research. Vivian Castillo, who is a UX researcher and a humanity and tech and diversity in tech advocate, is someone who spoke on the topic of empathy in UX research and why it's pretty bullshit what we've been doing up until this point. You can find her at madewithhumanity.com or at medium.com/@Vivian Castillo, which is where I'm getting this article that she wrote. It's called Part 2, The P Word, and the P word is privilege. So Vivian is a black woman in America, so she has a lot of views that haven't been spoken about, which definitely need to be, especially in tech and research. And she's coming from a place of a person who is a minority and someone who has experienced a lot of this firsthand. It's an awesome article. I definitely expect that you will read it, and I encourage you to read it. And I'm not going to go over all of it because there's a lot to unpack, but it's also a quick read, so I would definitely suggest checking it out. But I want to start kind of halfway down, which is where she outlines what privilege really means. So privilege is not an idea aimed at muting opinion or understanding the worth of accomplishments. It is not a stab at personal character, nor is it something for which one needs to apologize, but it is also not a myth. Privilege refers to the very real benefits that society affords certain groups over others, and it is manifested in many ways. She's saying that not enough people are taking a step back to evaluate their privilege, especially in tech, and in this case, what I'm going to be speaking about it is in UX research. And this can kind of affect how we go into interviews, it can affect how we view results, it can affect how we interpret people's responses because of all of the privilege that we're seeing it through. Our privilege is kind of like wearing different colored glasses in a way, because everything you see is going to be tainted from your own personal experience and the privilege that you've been afforded, even though it's invisible to you unless someone really points it out. So, for example, some privilege that people might not realize they have is heterosexual cisgender privilege. An example of Vivian gives is, you don't have to worry about family members and friends distancing themselves because you identify as a heterosexual cisgender woman. Someone who identifies on the gender spectrum as a woman and someone who is heterosexual, that is our society's default. And this affords people with a lot of privilege. Even though it might be difficult to get my foot in the door as a black woman in tech, it's even more difficult for a black transgender woman, she writes. So this is a privilege that you might not even realize that you had. For example, how many rom-coms have you watched that aren't about a cisgender heterosexual couple? Probably not very many, unless you're looking out for them explicitly. So this is the kind of privilege that we're seeing. Christian privilege, which is something I've been thinking about a lot as someone who grew up Christian, and this is something that we experience in the States as well as in Canada, where you never have to worry about not having Christian holidays off. You can wear symbols related to your religion, like a cross pendant, without being labeled as suspicious or dangerous. If you're a politician, you can share openly about being a Christian without losing votes, but what if a politician in America was running for office and publicly identified as devout Muslim? This is something else she points out. Christian privilege, religious privilege. She's talking mostly about America and North America. But this is something else to think about. And she goes on to also say socioeconomic privilege, which is the one that we usually hear about most often. So, you know, you're more likely to get hired by someone who was or is in the same socioeconomic class as you because we're drawn to people like us. This means that if someone grew up in a middle class background or high middle class background, they're more likely to relate to you and understand you and understand where you're coming from and therefore like you better in order for you to get a job more easily. It's harder for you to relate to people who don't have a similar upbringing or who don't have the similar experiences, which is just human nature. But it does afford people with privilege. In this sense, because if people who are only in middle-class backgrounds are managers because they had the money to go to school, to get the education, to become managers, and then they only hire people who did the same path as them, those people who have that are privileged, just plain and simple. And it's, like she said, it's nothing to be ashamed about, it's nothing to apologize for, but there is a way for you to use it in a way that's productive and something that won't blind you in your research practice. So this is where the research kind of comes in, and I see this a lot in business units and people who don't understand too much why empathy matters and why the customer experience really matters and the context really matters. And this is that unacknowledged privilege plus no empathy equals shallow and quick solutions without acknowledging the humanity within the problem of diversity. She's talked about diversity in the workplace, but you could also think about diversity in your research practice specifically, or diversity in the responses that you're getting in your research, et cetera, et cetera. So she says, in other words, stop going for the quick fix. And this is something we all want to do. I think as humans, we see something wrong and we just want to jump straight to fixing it. But when you do that, as many people do, and I'm sure many UX researchers can attest to this, you tell somebody what the problem is and they straight away want to go into the solution. What we're learning and what some people are unlearning and relearning and all kinds of things like that is that you can't just go straight into solutioning because you're just going to get a duct tape solution that when it really needs some careful planning and reworking and rebuilding, that takes a little bit more than duct tape just to fix it. By not listening to the problem, not understanding the problems, and not asking the right questions and getting deep into that empathetic research, we're really doing ourselves a disservice, the people that we're researching a disservice, and ultimately the business a disservice, because no one is going to like a solution that is thrown together with no idea how people will actually use it or respond to it or how it fits into their lives. And things like privilege do take into account how people live and how people work, how people will respond. So, not only do you need more diversity in the workplace, you also need to make sure that your privilege isn't inhibiting your ability to do good research. And this could mean things like she had spoken about this in her presentation, actually, but things like taking off your expensive jewelry before you go into a meeting, not bringing in your Starbucks cup or your expensive latte, because the people who are in there might see that as a status symbol, or do see that as a status symbol that you might be able to afford things they can't, and therefore they might not trust you. Things like bringing in your own moods and your own prejudices and your own privilege into the room. You don't even know you have all of this baggage because it's invisible to you, but it does affect how you do your research. And this privilege, especially, really does come into play in more places than you realize. All in all, I would definitely suggest you read Vivian Castillo's article titled Part Two, the P Word, and also read the rest of her series because it does talk more about how you can be more empathetic and actually employ these deep learning tools in order for us to actually be empathetic, to be actual good resources, to use your privilege for good by advocating results that might not just benefit straight white males in their mid to late 40s, who make up 80% of CEOs in America. Maybe you start thinking about things like AODA, which is the accessibility compliance law that is going into effect in 2020 in Canada, I believe. Things like that are important, but as an able-bodied person or as a heterosexual and cisgendered person, you might not realize that you have these things that are going for you. So don't waste your privilege, don't flaunt it either, and just be more aware of it so that you can be more empathetic and ultimately do better research. Moving into the last segment of today's episode, we are going to talk about different job opportunities that are out there for all of you UX researcher hopefuls, and also everyone who may or may not be looking for another position as a UX researcher. So to start it off, we have a UX researcher at Tal Group, which is a company looking for someone to study our customers, delivering deep insights and driving innovation. Here you'll work closely with product and marketing teams to define the most important research questions, lead research, facilitate synthesis to get compelling insights, and finally turn the insights into action. That is one of the many responsibilities, and they also require you to have expert skill in both evaluative and generative research methodologies, ability to establish priorities, work independently, and proceed with objectives without supervision, a minimum of 5 years experience with design research, so this might be for someone who's more intermediate, and you must have a desire to have fun while creating top-notch work that has incredible impact. So all applicants must be authorized to work in Canada, and it is based out of Mississauga, Ontario, which is outside of Toronto for those of you who don't know. Next, we have a very interesting job, which is a UX researcher at RBC in Toronto, which is where we are based. Fun fact. So UX research will play a key role in ensuring digital experiences are based on a strong foundation of well-understood client needs while impacting clearly defined business strategies. Fun fact, RBC has a great mobile app. It has one of the best ones that I've seen out of all of the banks. So I'm pretty sure they have a very solid UX team here, and I would not be surprised that you'd be among a bunch of really good UX researchers. So what's in it for you? They said we thrive on the challenge to be our best. You'll have leaders who support your development, ability to make a difference and lasting impact, work in a dynamic, collaborative, progressive, and high-performing team, and opportunities to take on progressively greater accountabilities, which basically means you may or may not be able to move up later on. So you'll be collaborating with business partners to plan research so you can better understand how key customers, better and reveal new opportunities. So you'll be developing research strategies, moderating workshops, collaborating closely with designers, product managers, engineers, other disciplines. So you have to be pretty cross-functional and comfortable with working with a lot of different teams, it sounds like, which can be scary, but it's also pretty cool when you can get everybody to work together, because that's how you get things done. So they want you to be comfortable working on ambiguous and multifaceted fuzzy problems with multidisciplinary teams and a dynamic environment, like I said before, ability to synthesize research, create, sell, and execute generative and evaluative research approaches. And they want you to have a graduate degree in design psychology, human factors, industrial design, human-computer interaction, or comparable work experience. So something like global business and digital arts from the University of Waterloo would definitely apply here, although it's not explicitly said. That is my degree, by the way. So RBC is Canada's largest bank. They are the most profitable company in Canada, and I'm sure the salary would be great. Just saying. So definitely consider that. It would be a contract, and you would be paid hourly, it looks like. The address is 88 Queens Quay, which is very nice, right on the water. So definitely would suggest that, and they're looking for someone who has at least a degree. So people who are new to UX research might not qualify for this one. It might be for someone who's a couple more years of experience. DoorDash in San Francisco is hiring a UX researcher, someone with 3+ years of experience, and they will give you bonus points if you have a PhD, MA, or MS in human-computer interaction, cognitive or experimental psychology, sociology, or a related field. I've been noticing that more and more people really want psychologists and sociologists on their team. I've actually worked with an anthropologist on my team before, and it's really interesting. Definitely wish I knew that I could do that and work in UX as a UX researcher. I had no idea that you could get your PhD in psychology and then become a UX researcher, but here we are. So definitely check that one out. We have TransferWise, a UX researcher in Great Britain, in London, England, if you're interested in that sort of thing. So TransferWise is pretty big right now. They're one of those companies that give you very low fees when you're transferring money across the border, and it has pretty much disrupted financial institutions, and they're growing pretty rapidly. So people rely on TransferWise to send their hard-earned money abroad, so they need to trust us, understand us, and hopefully like us too, they said. So UX research is really, really key in their business because they need people to trust them, have a great experience with them, and be happy with their service, because otherwise no one will trust them with their money. Good news about this one is you can be an early applicant because it was put up 2 days, sorry, not 2 days ago, 6 days ago. And you can easily apply through LinkedIn. Finally, we have a senior UX researcher for Ogilvy, which is in Denver, Colorado. It was posted 17 hours ago, so if you get on it, you might be one of the first people to apply. It is an associate position, so it sounds like they want you to have at least some experience. They want you to be able to present, facilitate key discussions, translate business and customer insights into actionable product opportunities, which means they will want you to work with the business and with the UX side of things, which will be fun. So they want you to have 3 or more years of work experience. Strong storytelling ability, which is something that is more and more in demand every day. Bachelor's and or master's degree in anthropology, design research, blah, blah, blah. We've all heard it before. All of those related fields. And knowledge of data analysis for analyzing survey and behavioral data is preferred additional. So if you have any knowledge in data analysis, quantitative analysis, statistics, things like that, that is a hugely marketable skill that you can definitely leverage as a UX researcher, in case you didn't know that. There are a lot of people who do the qualitative. There are not a lot of people who are willing to go deep into that Excel spreadsheet and figure out what the heck is going on. So data analysis, statistics, behavioral data in general, huge right now. Definitely would suggest you learn more about it if you don't know about it. And if you do know about it, you are one of the lucky ones, and that is a huge thing that you can definitely highlight on your resume, and it will be interesting to anybody who looks at it. That concludes this episode of Insights with your host, Emily Hutnick. Thank you so much for tuning in to the UXRTO podcast. As always, we are open to comments, questions, suggestions, cool emojis, anything you want, by emailing us at marketing@uxrto.com, or you can send us a voice message right here on Anchor. Finally, don't be afraid to get in touch on Slack. We have our very own Slack community, and if you want to be a part of that, you can also email us for the link at marketing@uxrto.com. There are over 500 of us right now, and we're growing every day, especially in anticipation of the next meetup in Toronto and the conference that is happening next year. Definitely check us out. Thank you again so much for listening, and I will speak to you later.